From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, how some banks are making big short-term profits buying tax liens, property taxes that have gone unpaid. The banks then add fees and boost interest rates on homeowners, making it even more difficult for the homeowner to meet their payments. We'll talk with investigative reporter Fred Schulte, who has written a series of articles on how banks are profiting from the distress of homeowners.
These banks, when they were in trouble, the taxpayers bailed them out. And now here they are running down to Florida or one of these other distressed real estate markets and buying up liens on people that can't pay their taxes.
Also, we talk with breast cancer oncologist Dr. Marisa Weiss, the founder of the popular website breastcancer.org, about being diagnosed with breast cancer herself last spring. And we remember diplomat Richard Holbrooke, who died yesterday. That's coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
The following is a paid advertisement for John Beck's newly updated free and clear real estate system. The average home in America now costs more than $219,000. But you're about to learn how you can start buying homes like these for just a few hundred dollars and own them free and clear with no additional monthly payments.
So that's an infomercial promoting a system to teach you, among other things, how to buy tax liens, the property taxes people owe and have been unable to pay. The idea is, if a person continues to be unable to pay and the house is foreclosed on, you may be able to take over the home, depending on what the local law is. Buying tax liens has actually become a big business for some banks and hedge funds who can make short-term profits by adding fees and boosting interest rates on homeowners, with the possibility in some cases of eventually taking over the homes. My guest Fred Schulte has been investigating how financial institutions, including some beneficiaries of bailout dollars, are creating new ways to profit from the financial distress of homeowners. Schulte is a reporter with the Huffington Post Investigative Fund. He formerly worked for the Baltimore Sun and the South Florida Sun Sentinel. He's a recipient of a George Polk Award and 3 Gerald Loeb Awards. Okay, so let's get back to that infomercial on how to profit from tax liens and tax deeds.
Hi, I'm Michelle Boudreau. The homes you just saw and the many examples you'll see throughout this program were all purchased for literally pennies on the dollar using the amazing secrets found in John Beck's Free and Clear Real Estate System. The secrets behind John's system are strategies that most people don't even know exist. Unique strategies that take full advantage of today's real estate market to purchase homes all across the country for as little as a few hundred dollars. And John's strategies don't just apply to homes, they apply to all kinds of real estate.
Well, Fred Schulte, welcome to Fresh Air. So we just heard this infomercial for John Beck Amazing Profits. Are there a lot of people who are offering classes or courses in how to invest in tax liens and take over properties cheaply?
There are. There are many of these groups on the internet. If you could just Google them and tax lien, and tons of them come up, and they all are selling some sort of course or way to make a lot of money on tax liens.
So what's the premise? How is an individual supposed to make money by buying tax liens?
Well, a tax lien is an unpaid property tax or utility bill or something of that order. And in about 29 states, these liens are sold usually on an annual basis to investors. And you can, in fact, buy the right to collect that debt. And in some states, that can mean that you can get 18 or even more, 18% interest on that debt. You can also attach a lot of legal fees and other charges onto the debt. So that's how you make money on it.
So just so I understand this, so if somebody can't pay their taxes on their property or their home and the county has given up trying to collect the taxes from this person, they can sell the debt, they can sell the tax lien to an individual investor or to a bank, which we'll get into later. And then the person who's taken over the tax lien can raise the interest, add fees, and start making money. So do I have that right?
That's right.
Okay. So the ad that we just heard for John Beck Amazing Profits, how to invest in tax liens, he's being sued or his company is being sued by the Federal Trade Commission. What for?
Well, the Federal Trade Commission is alleging that Beck's course is misrepresenting the benefits of tax lien investing. And one of the premises is that for pennies on the dollar, you can buy these properties. And the position of the FTC is that you don't, in fact, buy properties for pennies on the dollar. And some of this gets to the whole issue of the lien, purchasing the right to collect a debt rather than the home. And some people don't quite understand the difference, and this has some tax collectors a little concerned because people think that they may think that they're actually buying the home for the amount of the taxes. That's not what you're buying. What you're buying is the right to collect the debt. Now, when you collect the debt, you can add on all these fees and you can get an interest rate that is set by law in the various states. So it can be a very profitable endeavor, but it's not quite the same as buying a house for like a $600 tax debt to buy a $200,000 house for $600. It isn't quite that simple.
Now, what you've been writing about isn't really the individual investor, the kind of person that Beck is addressing himself to, as much as like banks and hedge funds. That's what you've been focusing on. Why are banks and hedge funds starting to buy up massive amounts of tax liens?
Well, because there's a lot of money in it. And we have been looking more from the position of the homeowner and the person who actually has to pay all of these fees and things, not so much at the people that are investing hoping to make money off of the woes of the homeowner. But banks and hedge funds have, in fact, been in the tax lien investing business for some years, but with the advent of the online auctions that are being held in a number of states, most notably in Florida, there's a great opportunity for people who have access to very cheap money, which would be a bank, to come in and buy these debts. And you're talking about, in Florida, hundreds of millions of dollars invested very, very quickly. So the banks have the opportunity to, they have the access to the money. They can buy these things quickly. Most people will redeem the debt fairly quickly at a decent interest rate, and so that's how the bank makes money.
So you mean most people, once the bank takes over the tax lien, pay back the debt?
They do, because, a lot of times you're talking about a debt that's $700 in property taxes or $800, and your home is worth $60,000 or $100,000, and obviously the economics are such that if you're the homeowner, you're going to try to come up with the money in order to keep your home. So the bank knows that and expects a quick redemption. That's one strategy in buying tax liens. There's another group of investors, and it's not so much the banks and the hedge funds, that are actually looking to get the property. And that can be a lengthy process, but you can, in fact, sue to obtain the property if your demands aren't met for the payment.
So who are those investors that are looking to take over the property?
Well, some of them are people that work in urban areas and that are rehabbers and that sort of thing that that was one of the original ideas behind selling these tax liens, is you have a piece of property in an inner city, and it's not generating any taxes because the owners have abandoned it or walked away from it. But the city then will say, well, if we could sell this to a new investor and they fix it up and resell it to somebody, then that property would be added to the tax rolls. That would be a good thing for the city. So there are people that are going out looking for properties like this where the taxes are delinquent. I think where we saw some problems was if you didn't have a mortgage on the home. Let's say you'd owned the home for and you've lived in it all your life, or it was your parents' home, and then the kids are living there and the kids are adults, and so there's no mortgage on the property, but you fall behind in the taxes, then there's no mortgage company that's going to come forward to try to pay the taxes on your behalf in order to save the property. And in that kind of a situation, you're really vulnerable to losing the property over taxes. We had a situation in Baltimore where a woman didn't pay a $300 water bill. Her family had owned the home for almost 30 years. There was no mortgage on the property, but she didn't pay this $300 water bill. Well, over time, as she didn't pay it, it escalated and the legal fees kicked in, and then pretty soon she owed thousands of dollars and she couldn't pay it, and so she ended up losing the house.
Well, whose legal fees kicked in?
Well, the legal fees from the are because you can't just force somebody out of their house. You have to file a lawsuit against them to foreclose. They call it to foreclose on their right to redeem the debt. It gets a little technical and a little complicated, but essentially you sue to take the property from them. And as that goes through the courts, the legal fees add up. There's title search fees. There's all these fees. And then you end up with a $300, $400 debt morphing into $4,000 or $5,000. And that sinks some of these property owners, and they end up losing the house.
So in other words, those expenses are charged to the homeowner.
Oh, they are, absolutely, and that's
the legal expenses that it takes to drive the homeowner out of their home are charged to the homeowner.
Yeah, they are.
So let's talk a little bit about how banks are investing more than ever in tax liens. What's in it for the banks, and why are they investing more now than before?
Well, for the Bank of America, the Bank of America came down into Florida and spent hundreds of millions of dollars buying these up, and That was in late May and early June when the various counties around the state held these mostly online tax sale auctions. They purchased the liens along with a Wall Street hedge fund, the Fortress Investment Group, and then they later put them into a securities package and resold them on as a Wall Street bond deal.
So if a bank invests in a tax lien, at what point are they allowed to take over the property if the homeowner hasn't paid the tax debt?
That depends on the state. In some states, as little as 6 months after the sale, they can file a lawsuit 6 months after the purchase of the lien and attempt to take your house from you. In other states, it's longer. In like Florida, it's 2 years.
So banks are now investing in these tax liens through internet sales, because the tax liens are sold in auctions on the internet as opposed to the way they used to be, which is auctions in a room where people would show up. So how has that changed the whole nature of investing in tax liens?
Well, it's put the whole process on steroids. And when you have these banks doing this over the internet, they're creating all kinds of corporate alter egos and strange names and limited liability companies that are bidding on these things. And, you know, like I said, they have access to a large amount of money, and they come in and they really rev up the system. I mean, it used to be that there were just a few people sitting around in a room holding up paddles at these auctions. Now you have a situation where anybody in the world can be bidding anonymously, and millions and millions of dollars is changing hands here in a matter of minutes. And there's very little known about who the people are that are buying them. But for the banks, they're able to dominate the process because they have a ready supply of money.
Why would the banks need to come up with alter ego names, with names of other companies, just to invest online in these tax liens? Why can't they just invest in their own name?
Well, we've asked them that. We never really got a satisfactory answer to that question. But I mean, some people think that this is a business that they would rather not talk about. I mean, they want to get the money from it, but they really don't want to be publicly identified with a business that some people say is, you know, benefiting from the economic misfortune of others. I mean, one of the things that we looked at also was that some of the banks doing this had been recipients of bailout money from the taxpayers. And so some critics were telling us, critics of this whole process were saying, well, you know, these banks, when they were in trouble, the taxpayers bailed them out. And now here they are running down to Florida or one of these other distressed real estate markets and buying up liens on people that can't pay their taxes. And, you know, it can be devastating to lose your home. I think if you're the person taking that home, I don't think it's something necessarily that you want everyone to know you're doing.
So if banks are using aliases in some instances, then the counties don't really know who they're selling the liens to. Should the county care? Does it matter?
Well, they haven't really thought about it, I think, traditionally. And I think some of them, in fact, are starting to care, because anytime you're selling millions and millions of dollars worth of liens and you have no idea who you're selling them to, it's just some, you know, blankety-blank LLC, and you have no idea who those people are. You have no idea who the funding source is for these people. You have no idea whether they're U.S. companies or not. We had, in the recent Florida auctions, there were some from the islands, you know, the Cayman Islands and that sort of thing. And so some of the tax collectors are, in fact, getting a little concerned that they don't really know who is buying up these certificates. They call them tax lien certificates.
My guest is Fred Schulte, a reporter with the Huffington Post Investigative Fund. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Fred Schulte. He's written a series of investigative articles about banks and hedge funds investing in tax liens and profiting from the distress of homeowners. So who are the biggest players among the banks and the hedge funds investing in the tax liens now?
Well, the Bank of America, J.P. Morgan, the Fortress Hedge Fund Group, those are three of the real big players.
Now, the Fortress Investment Group, which is a hedge fund, is headed by Daniel Mudd, who used to be the head of Fannie Mae.
That's correct.
So what is interesting about that?
Well, I mean, he's it's a big fund. I mean, they manage billions of dollars. But, I mean, I think that some critics have wondered why somebody that was involved on this the government end of these mortgages is now on the other end, taking advantage of people who can't pay their mortgages and potentially taking their property.
You've been investigating homeowners whose tax liens have been sold. What are you learning about what homeowners are up against when their tax liens are sold to banks or hedge funds?
Well, what they tend to be up against is a lot of fees and a very high interest rate. I think one of the things that that homeowners need to understand is that if you're having trouble financially or you've lost your job, you must pay your property taxes, because if you don't, you can be thrown into this this web of fees and uncertainty, and that you can in fact be sued and have your property taken from you for a debt that's only a few hundred dollars. So I think when it's your house, you really need to pay that first and foremost.
It's easy to see why cities and counties would want to sell the tax liens, because if a homeowner isn't paying the tax, it means that the city or county isn't getting that money. And the more people who can't afford to pay their taxes, which is the kind of situation we're in now, the less money the city or the county makes. And this is especially bad at a time like we're in now, when cities and counties are really hurting for money. So in the short term, it makes sense that they'd want to sell these tax liens and get the money that they're owed. But in the long term, are there questions down the line that you think might come up that might make things not so great for cities and counties who've sold a lot of tax liens?
Well, there are. I mean, obviously, the city or the county gets immediate cash by doing this. In Dade County, Miami-Dade County in Florida, in 2009, over $300 million came in the day of the tax sale. So that was all money that they would have had to go out and collect some other way. So obviously, there's a quick infusion of cash. Down the road, what does this mean? Well, some people think that it increases foreclosures. And in Cleveland, for example, they decided not to hold a tax sale auction this year because the previous ones had resulted in a lot of foreclosures. And they figured, well, wait a minute, this is making the foreclosure rate even worse. So that can be one of the problems that you get with the sale of these liens. If a lien owner buys the lien on it, and let's say it's an abandoned building, then they don't keep it up and it gets run down. And so neighborhoods can deteriorate. So some people are thinking, well, you know, it might have been smarter to figure out a way to get those taxes paid on a payment basis, or find some other method to try to get the homeowner to pay, rather than just selling it off and then not knowing who's going to buy it and what's going to happen.
To do this story, you've probably spent a whole lot of time with public records, going through them.
Yeah. Well, and lawsuits, and I mean, I think that's how you do this kind of a story. I mean, data analysis was critical to this, and also a lot of time in the courthouse, because these cases always end up in court, and in court, people can't be anonymous. They have to be a real person. As far as the online tax sale auctions, all that data is available online, and so you can download it, and you do that, and you can see the patterns and who's buying them. And then what we had to do is figure out who, in fact, they were. We kept seeing these, you know, names like Bennu LLC and Ecru LLC and all these different LLCs. And so it's a whole other research job to try to figure out who, in fact, Bennu and Ecru are. And that took a long time. Lots of phone calls, lots of requests for public records. The Bank of America.
And you found that out by how?
I traced them to a post office box in Atlanta, which is the official address that they use for conduct of business. Then I called and made information requests with tax collectors all over Florida, and eventually got enough information in to see that, in fact, the contact person for these companies was I was able to link that person to Bank of America.
You've invested a lot of time into researching the story on the sale of tax liens and how that's affecting homeowners who can't afford to pay their city or county taxes. This is obviously a really important story to you. What makes it that important to you?
Well, I think that the issue is fairness. I mean, and everybody would like to have a home and own a home, and some people that have owned a home for generations want to keep it. And I think that the issue is that how do you balance society's needs to collect taxes with the rights of the property owner not to be just tossed out? And the other issue is, of course, does the penalty fit the crime? I mean, I think that's one of the big things with this. Not that this is a crime, but a debt. If you have a debt of a few hundred dollars, should that debt be able to morph into thousands and thousands of dollars, which de facto sinks you and causes you to be chucked out of your house, particularly a house that you've owned free and clear for years? And I think that's the tension in the story for us. And so it is kind of like, well, we know that the county or the city has to collect its money, but does it have to do it in such a way as that it imposes thousands of dollars in these fees and really damages people? And then if that happens, who walks away with that money? And is it right, is it fair that some bank walks away with thousands of dollars here over your inability to pay your taxes and or walks away with your house?
Fred Schulte, thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Fred Schulte's series of articles about how banks are profiting from homeowners' distress are published by the Huffington Post Investigative Fund. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Chevrolet, maker of the Bolt. It's more a car than electric. Available soon in select markets. Details at ChevyBolt.com. From the Kauffman Foundation, working to grow economies and expand human welfare. Learn more at Kauffman.org. And from Angie's List, providing consumer reviews on local professionals from physicians and veterinarians to plumbers and roofers. Details at AngiesList.com. This is NPR.
Coming up, breast cancer oncologist Dr. Marisa Weiss, the founder of the website breastcancer.org, talks about being diagnosed with the disease last spring. And we remember diplomat Richard Holbrooke and listen back to a story he told about negotiating with the leaders of the Bosnian Serbs, two people he considered evil incarnate. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Dr. Marisa Weiss is one of the go-to doctors for women diagnosed with breast cancer. She's the author of Living Well Beyond Breast Cancer and is the founder of breastcancer.org, a popular breast cancer resource website. She's a breast oncologist at Lankenau Hospital in the Philadelphia area. Last spring, after getting her annual mammogram, Dr. Weiss was diagnosed with breast cancer. After taking time off for treatment, she returned to her practice. We invited her to talk about what she describes as having dual citizenship as a doctor and a patient. Dr. Marisa Weiss, welcome to Fresh Air. So let me just start by asking you, how's your health now?
I actually feel better now than I did before I was diagnosed. I've had to learn how to take care of myself in the same way that I've prescribed to my patients over the 20 years that I've been in practice. And I've really focused on not just what the doctors have told me to do, and I've done that, but also on what I'm doing in my everyday life, you know, what I'm eating, what I'm drinking, what I'm breathing in, the personal products I'm using, from, you know, the kitchen cabinet to the bathroom shelves to the cleaning supplies. And I've, you know, had to get my act together in a number of different ways. And with all that work, there's been a big return on investment, and I feel a lot better.
So you are surrounded by people who have breast cancer because you're an oncologist who treats women with breast cancer. So did you worry before getting it yourself that you would get it? Because you see it all the time. It's so business as usual for you.
Right. I mean, breast cancer is basically my whole life. Many people, my family have had it.
Your mother had it.
My mother has had it. My aunt just passed away, actually, from it this past spring.
Sorry to hear that.
Yeah. I have relatives I have never met who had it, whom I've heard stories about. I have taken care of thousands of women. And then through breastcancer.org, there are 10 million people that come to us that I feel like I have a relationship with over the years. And yes, I was always concerned and aware that could happen to me. I never thought that I would get a free pass because I've been a good girl and, you know, worked hard to help other people and that somehow would magically protect me. But when it happened to me, it was a shock because, you know, I was a very busy person and during a very busy day like anybody else, I had to break away from my schedule to race up to the mammography department, take the white coat off, all the clothes off, waist up off. Wait in that gown, wait to be called. And I thought it was just going to be like any other year where I would get the films. They would call me back for a few extra pictures, as they always do. And then they would say, good, everything looks great. Catch up to you next year. But that didn't happen this year. So
you give the news all the time to your patients. What was it like to get the news?
Well, the news didn't come all at one time. It started with, I see some changes on the mammogram that are worrisome. So then I said, well, how worried are you? The radiologist said, I'm pretty worried. So right away I knew that there was a change that was significant and that those words were serious words. And then I had to come back, and I was lucky to get an appointment to come back the next day for extra pictures, so extra mammogram pictures to zero in on the area that they were concerned about, an ultrasound. And each of those tests showed more reason for worry and concern. Then I had to race out of the hospital to be the keynote speaker for a luncheon of 400 women an hour away and then drive back. Breast cancer, of course. That's, as I said, it's your life. And for my MRI scan at the end of the day. And after that test, I came out and looked at the faces of the radiology technicians who operate the machines, and they wouldn't look at me. They were just avoiding my glance. So I knew then it was serious. And then I went from there to the radiology reading room and met with a radiologist who pulled the MRI images fresh up on the screen. And like a light bulb, there it was, this a tumor in my left breast that was clearly a cancer. And while it hadn't yet been biopsied, I've been doing this for so long, I knew I had breast cancer. That was a really tough weekend because that was a Friday night, and the weekend I spent with my son, and I wasn't really able to share anything with him because I didn't want to upset him unnecessarily in case perhaps it may not be cancer.
So with all this evidence, the different tests that you had taken together, what did you learn about your breast cancer that you might not have been able to learn had you been diagnosed, say, 15 years ago?
Well, what is amazing to me is that we have had advances in many different specialties in breast cancer treatment and diagnosis that are teamed up with better detection. So I had the benefit of early detection with mammography. And because it was found early, I also was able to take advantage of a new test called the Oncotype DX test which is like an FBI report on the proteins and genes that turn on and turn off breast cancer cell growth and also make the breast cancer able to invade normal tissue and spread to other parts of the body. So I got that test result, and it showed that my risk of having distant recurrence 10 years from now was low. And because of the result of that test, I was able to avoid chemotherapy and instead have hormonal therapy medicines that block the effects of estrogen on breast cells. The medicine's called tamoxifen in my situation. There are many different kinds of medicines in that category. So I feel that I benefited from early detection in more ways than one. I had an earlier diagnosis, a better prognosis, and also was able to avoid treatments that could have had significant side effects, both immediate as well as lingering in the future.
So was there a part of you that was saying, even though the analysis of my tumor says that it's not the kind of tumor that's likely to recur or spread, do I have that right? And therefore, you know, you don't have to do the chemo or the radiation, surgery should be sufficient. Was there a little voice in your head saying, but just in case, maybe I should do the chemo or maybe I should do the radiation? Because I've certainly heard women say that, you know, they probably don't need it, but they were urged, just in case, go through those treatments.
Right. I mean, we have this human nature tendency to think that more is better. But for me, my greatest benefit was going to come from hormonal therapy, not chemotherapy. And I know that the type of cancer I have is the kind that can recur much later, not just within the first 5 years, but within 10 years or 15 years. So I need long-term protection. So I've had to get very serious about making sure I'm as healthy as possible and that I don't expose myself to outside hormones or chemicals that can act like hormones and address sort of my internal environment and make that as healthy as possible. So, for example, I got my weight down. I lost 13 pounds and try to stick to it. I limit the amount of alcohol I drink to 5 or fewer drinks per week. I usually stick to 2 or 3 drinks or fewer per week because those two things are closely associated with breast cancer risk and breast cancer recurrence. I've never smoked, but I also stay even further away from people who smoke. I make sure that I have hormone-free sources of beef or dairy products. I avoid any foods that have that are heavily treated with pesticides like apples, peaches, celery, bell peppers, any kind of berries, because some of those pesticides can act like, taste like, smell like estrogen to your breast cells on the inside. I'm also very careful about trying to exercise 3 or 4 hours a week, something I don't really like doing, which takes a lot of discipline.
I know obesity might be a factor, but you're quite slim. Why did you feel you needed to lose weight?
Well, I was overweight when I was diagnosed, only somewhat overweight, but obesity is connected to a higher risk of breast cancer because the extra fat makes extra hormones. Also, a lot of the chemicals in the environment that can act like estrogen, they dissolve in fat and your body can harbor them. And people who are overweight tend to be less physically active and eat less nutritious food. And it's also true that there's some interaction. So when overweight women drink alcohol, there's more of an effect than when thin women drink alcohol. So I knew that managing my weight, something I've struggled with my whole life, was something I had to really get real about and get to a healthy weight and stick to it and change my life in order to make that happen.
So you're talking about avoiding anything that behaves in the body like estrogen does because your kind of breast cancer feeds on estrogen.
That's right.
So we've been hearing for years that the hormonal treatments, the estrogen treatments that were supposed to help women through menopause and help stave off memory loss and be good for the heart actually can feed breast cancer cells and make you more prone to breast cancer. And there's a new study that says not only that, but it can create a more aggressive form of breast cancer. And stop me if I'm getting any of this wrong.
No, it's exactly right. It's like fertilizer. Yeah. So basically, when you take pharmaceutical estrogens from the outside environment into your inside environment, inside your body, you're basically marinating your cells in a substance that's going to promote its growth. So breast cells are very responsive to hormones as well as medications or chemicals that can act like hormones. And when you're constantly being marinated in a mix that contains hormone replacement therapy, the cells can become overactive and become cancer cells. And so that study, the recent study, shows that women are at higher risk for getting breast cancer and breast cancer that's more aggressive, that's gone to lymph nodes. So the paper really asks doctors and patients to have a conversation about this and say, you know what? Maybe it's time to get off of hormone replacement therapy, reevaluate what symptoms you might have, find safer, effective remedies for managing postmenopausal symptoms like hot flashes or dryness or things like that.
Did you have to decide whether or not to tell your patients that you were diagnosed with breast cancer, the same thing you were treating them for?
Yes, it was very difficult to figure out exactly how I disclosed my own diagnosis to my patients because I didn't want them worrying about me when the reason why we're meeting is to take care of them.
And also worrying that you're not going to be their doctor, that maybe you'll decide to leave.
Right.
Maybe it'll be just too much stress, too much time.
Right. No, there was
maybe you won't be well enough. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think all of those concerns weighed on their minds. So in my usual style of being open, I was upfront. I let the people know who were under treatment at that time that I was going to have a medical procedure and I was going to be out for the week and that I expected to be back soon and I expected to be, you know, fully able and competent to be their doctor and that while I was away, there would be full coverage. And then when I came back, you know, they were asking me, well, are you okay and what happened? I said, thank you for your concern. I was diagnosed with an early stage breast cancer and I have...
So it was only after you came back you revealed that?
We decided that it was best to share the information in stages and not overwhelm them with too much information at one time, particularly when I myself needed the privacy and needed and didn't have all the answers.
Right.
So I divulged as much as I thought I could share that was reasonable and knowing that we would continue the conversation when new information became available.
How'd they take it?
I've gotten tremendous support from my patients. They've expressed, you know, true compassion. I've gotten beautiful letters and phone calls. It made a big difference to me. And I've, you know, I'm very grateful for that.
My guest is Dr. Marisa Weiss, a breast cancer oncologist and the founder of breastcancer.org. She was diagnosed with breast cancer last spring. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dr. Marisa Weiss, a breast cancer oncologist and the founder of breastcancer.org. She was diagnosed with breast cancer last spring. So one of the things you're concerned about is not exposing yourself to environmental hazards and to certain, you know, products that you think can have an estrogen-like effect in your body. And you're in the process of writing a book about environmental issues that might increase risk of breast cancer or breast cancer recurrence. So let's run through some of your specific concerns about that. I don't know if you want to start with food.
Well, let me just say that breast cancer used to be pretty uncommon about 100 years ago. And what's happened is that the breast has become the favorite place for cancer to occur in this day and age.
And we all know people, I think I can say this and speak for everybody, say we all know people who have had breast cancer. So what are some of the explanations of why the breast has become the favorite location for cancer?
Well, most people think it's all about family history and genes you may have inherited from your family. But actually, the breast cancer genes only explain 5 to 10% of breast cancer cases today. And those are ancient, stable abnormalities. They haven't changed. But what has changed over the years that explains why the breast has become the favorite place for cancer to occur are changes in our outside environment and our body's inside environment. So in terms of the inside environment, with obesity making extra inside hormones that can influence breast cell growth, it also triggers more insulin growth factor. More women are drinking alcohol. More women have not stopped smoking. They've started, but they haven't stopped as quickly as men have. We lead very stressful lives. We don't sleep enough. We're running ourselves ragged. We're not giving our bodies a chance to heal from the wear and tear of everyday living. From the outside environment, we bring into our body's inside environment what were the food. For example, the most commonly grown crops today, corn and soy, are grown with atrazine and Roundup. Atrazine can turn on...
What is atrazine?
Atrazine is a herbicide, is a weed killer that's used to grow corn. Roundup is a weed killer used to grow soy. Those seeds are genetically modified to grow in the presence of those chemicals. But we haven't been genetically modified to withstand the side effects of atrazine and Roundup. Atrazine can stimulate the production of estrogen in your body by turning on the aromatase enzyme. And Roundup is a hormone disruptor. It can kind of rock the boat and mess up the balances of hormones in your body. But all these chemicals, they are used in agriculture or industry. They can get into the food that we eat, the water we drink, and they can have an influence, an unhealthy influence on our breast cells.
Why breast cells and why not different parts of the body?
Well, actually, the breast is a very unique organ. It is the only organ to essentially fully form after you've been born. All the other organs, and including the very beginning of the breast tissue, is formed during the first 3 months of pregnancy. And during that time, of course, the breast cells are exquisitely sensitive to any kind of genetic insult as they're building themselves. But then the breast is the only organ in the body to actually fully form. And over a 10-year period of time, from ages 8 to 18 and into your 20s, and that is when what you're eating, drinking, breathing in, and using are the actual building blocks. And that's when you're laying down the foundation of your future breast health. So, for example, exposures to DES when you're building your breast tissue in utero produce a higher risk of breast cancer in the mothers as well as the daughters later in life. Bisphenol A can have a permanent effect on the way the breast is formed if you're exposed to it in utero or later on during breast development. So that's one unique thing about the breast. Also, the estrogen receptor that runs operations in most breast cells is like a sponge for all of these different chemicals. While it has a monogamous relationship with estrogen, it is ready to respond and is quite promiscuous when it comes to all these other chemicals, and they can turn on breast cell growth. And what has also happened is that girls are going through breast development way earlier. For African-American girls, it can start as early as, age 8, 7 or 8. For white girls, it's around age 10. For Latina girls, it's like 9.5. And then as soon as the breasts are made, they're ready to respond to these chemicals. And the breast cells remain quite immature and overactive until the first full-term pregnancy, which is the first time in the life of the breast when the breast is forced to actually fully grow up, get its act together, and get a job breastfeeding. And what's happened today is that breast development is happening earlier and earlier, and many women are delaying having their first full-term pregnancy or not having children at all, or are not breastfeeding. And during that long stretch, the breast cells are immature and very responsive to outside chemicals that you may bring into your inside environment. Those combination of reasons explain largely why breast cancer has become the most common cancer to affect women.
So I know before you actually had your breast surgery, you got photographed. So that you'd have a photo of your intact breast.
Mm-hmm.
What have you done with the photograph, and do you ever look at it?
Well, a friend of mine called me before my surgery and said, take a picture of them. And I said, why? She goes, you want to remember them, the way they are now. So I asked my husband, and he said, no, I don't want to do that. So I called my sister, and she said, oh, there's a place called pinkkitty.com. And I called them, and they said, we're having a special. So So I decided that I was going to do it. I was so happy that I did because it sort of captured the moment. It was fun. It took the edge off my anxiety going into surgery. They put me up against a very cold exterior wall, and my breasts went right up to the original position. And they looked fabulous when the picture was taken. So I will remember them that way. I was really pleased that I had done that. It was a lot of fun, and I haven't done anything with the photographs, but I have them sort of tucked away for a sneak peek whenever I want to, you know, remember them in their glory.
Dr. Weiss, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Marisa Weiss is the founder of BreastCancer.org and the author of Living Well Beyond Breast Cancer. She was diagnosed with breast cancer last spring. Coming up, we remember Richard Holbrook. This is Fresh Air. Richard Holbrook had some extraordinary experiences during his career as a U.S. diplomat. We're going to hear about one that he described in our 1998 interview. Holbrook died yesterday after surgery for a torn aorta. He had been serving as President Obama's special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. He worked for every Democratic president since the late 1960s. His greatest accomplishment was as the chief architect of the Dayton Peace Accords, negotiating an end to the war in Bosnia in 1995. The Balkan War had shocked the world with the siege of Sarajevo and the forced relocation and slaughter of Muslims in Bosnia in what was described as ethnic cleansing. I spoke with Richard Holbrook in 1998 after the publication of his memoir, To End a War.
In the times that you've dealt with Milosevic, the head of Serbia, have you felt that you were dealing with evil incarnate, which is often the way he's been portrayed?
I've dealt with so many leaders over the last 25 years who represented things alien to the American tradition. And with Milosevic, I felt I was dealing and continue to deal with a person whose behavior and style and activities are just totally incompatible with those that we believe in. But the word evil is a very powerful word, and I want to depersonalize it. There is evil in the world as something that we have to confront. But the time that I felt I was in the presence of evil, incarnate evil, was the extraordinary 13-hour negotiation we had to have in September of 95 outside Belgrade with Mladic and Karadzic, the two indicted war criminals who led the Bosnian Serbs. These were hands-on murderers. It was like spending a day with Pol Pot. And having spent most of my career in Asia, I was acutely aware of the sense that this was the Pol Pot of Europe.
Well, before you even met with them, you had to decide whether it was morally justifiable to actually meet with them as part of the peace talks, because after all, they were indicted war criminals. So what made you decide that it was the appropriate thing to do, to meet with them?
We debated this on the plane flying into Belgrade. I said to my team, look, sooner or later, we're probably going to end up meeting with these two terrible men, Radovan Karadzic, the political leader of the Bosnian Serbs, and Ratko Mladic, the murderous general who runs the military. And each of you has a choice here. Do you want to meet with them or not? Do you want to shake hands with them or not? We unanimously concluded, as had previous negotiators, that it's better to deal with these men to save the lives of people who are still alive as the best way of honoring those who had already died, rather than get up on one's high moral horse and refuse to meet with them. However, because they were indicted war criminals, we made clear to them and to Milosevic that they couldn't enter the United States or any European country, Western European country, without facing immediate arrest under UN resolutions. Now, in making the decision to meet with them, I happen to have been very influenced personally by two books that my wife, Kati Martin, had written, one on Bernadotte and one on Wallenberg. Both those men, both Swedes, had met in 1944-45 with Eichmann and Himmler to save hundreds of thousands of Jews throughout Central Europe by meeting with these horrendous people. And they had saved lives, and I thought that was a valid model. So in the end, we met with these people. I chose not to shake hands with them. Some of my colleagues did. But I think that the historical record shows that the decision to meet with them was correct. I might also add that everyone else had met with them routinely and not even felt it was a moral dilemma. But I thought it was.
Richard Holbrooke, recorded in 1998. He died yesterday. He was 69. You can download podcasts of our show on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Sherrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Joan Tuohy-Westman, Sam Brigger, John Myers, John Sheehan, Lauren Krenzel, and Heidi Simon. Our show was directed today by Sue Spolin. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from Subaru, where all vehicles are built in zero landfill plants. Love, it's what makes a Subaru a Subaru. From Plowshares Fund, dedicated to helping build a safe, secure, and nuclear weapon-free world at plowshares.org. And from the Overbrook Foundation, supporting catalogchoice.org, a nonprofit service that allows customers to decide which catalogs to receive in the mail. This is NPR.
The new film Blue Valentine is about a couple whose relationship has turned sour. On the next Fresh Air, the film's star, Ryan Gosling, talks about unusual filming techniques, including moving in for a month with his co-star Michelle Williams and their on-screen child. Gosling is best known for his roles in Lars and the Real Girl, Half Nelson, and The Notebook. Join us.